Welcome to the inaugural official NNGA podcast. I'm here today with Greg Miller, Jerry Henkin, and Tucker Hill. And we're here today to talk to you about the history of the NNGA. So first, let's go ahead and start with an introduction. Greg, can you start us off and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Greg Miller. I am current president of the NNGA, and I have been a member of the NNGA since late 1970s. My father was a member since the early 1960s, so my history for the NNGA goes back at least half of its lifespan. I'm not here at it's a full-time job. Did I say that already?
No, you did not.
Okay.
Great. Jerry Henkin, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Sure. Thank you. Jerry Henkin, Yonkers, New York, currently the NNGA librarian. I've been a member about 30 years, served on the board of directors, helped put together the annual NNGA conference for quite a number of years. I'm working now on putting together the conference with NAFEX in Iowa in 2019 in the summer. I, for the last 10 years, have been the librarian. As such, I have the complete NNGA annual report, much of the nutshells dating from way back of our organization. I have books, some magazines, some CDs from the organization, and a collection of what went on in NNGA annual conferences with photographs of the participants. And I've recently been in touch with a number of NNGA members, and some who are not members, who want the information in the annual reports. It's really a treasure. So that's what I'm up to.
Great. Thanks, Jerry. And just a reminder, if you are a member of the NNGA, you can email or contact Jerry to receive physical copies of anything in the library. So check out our website at nutgrowing.org for more information on that. Tucker, will you please introduce yourself?
Okie dokie. I'm Tucker Hill. I'm the Secretary Emeritus of the Northern Nut Growers. That was an honor that was bestowed on me shortly after I resigned after being the Secretary for 17 years, 12 of which I edited the newsletter. And I've been involved also for about 30 years, the same as Jerry. I remember talking to Jerry at the very first meeting he attended. And my interest in nut trees has gone back to my childhood when I had to collect black walnuts, seedling black walnuts, and no gloves. You just take the husk off with your bare hands, and we ended up with extra dark, beautiful fingers, and couldn't wash it off. And we enjoyed going to a school, to an elementary country school, and they didn't give us any problem because they knew that we had to do that sort of work. And so currently we have a nut tree orchard, about, I think, around 70, 80 trees. And we're kind of winding down. We're running out of energy, but that's the way life goes.
Thank you all for being here. I was really excited to get the three of you together on a phone call because I'd say the three of you have taught me mostly everything I know about the organization. Again, this is just kind of a free form conversation. I would just like to cover today the general history of the NNGA and its impact, members and non-members alike. So Greg, can you tell me first how your father got started with the NNGA and kind of what his history was with the organization?
My father grew up on a farm in Stark County, Ohio. And as a child, he lamented the fact that the habit of farmers was to clear forest and turn it into cropland. And he thought, you know, if I ever get the chance someday, I'm going to buy some open farm ground and turn it back into forest. It also happened that when he was a child walking to school, one time he brought home some black walnuts that he picked up between his house and the school, and he planted them in his yard. As far as I know, those trees are still there. And even when I was a kid, we would go over and harvest the nuts and run them through the hand crank corn sheller to get the hulls off. And so that was my kind of my first experience with nut growing were trees that my dad planted as a child. So when he did finally get enough money, which back in late 1950s, it didn't take much money to buy land, he bought a farm and planted white pines on it and planted every kind of nut tree he could get a hold of. And that's when he became involved in NNGA. You know, once you get in the organization, pretty soon you start planting a little bit of everything. And kind of the short version of the subsequent story is that after planting every kind of nut tree that would grow here in East Central Ohio, and planting lots of nut trees that wouldn't grow here, we discovered that chestnuts did really well. And so what was his hobby sort of got out of control and became my business.
I like how like the childhood experience has turned into a full-time job. It's pretty neat. Jerry, can you talk a little bit about how you got involved with the NNGA and kind of what interested you?
I did gardening. I've always done gardening, you know, in community gardens. And about 35 years ago, one of the women who I was helping, she was elderly at the time, pointed out on the way home from the community garden that there was a tree there in the fall with something coming down, and she asked if I knew what it was. I had no idea. Well, it was a black walnut, and I got intrigued by that, did a little research, and eventually contacted Tucker Hill and the NNGA, started coming to meetings. I see nut growing as an important source of food security for the future. And that's something that I'm very much involved in, sort of as a personal mission to help people have enough food to eat in addition to growing nuts. For the long term, I grow bean sprouts. For the short term, another way of having food that's highly nutritious for people.
Perfect. All right. Tucker, can you talk a little bit about how you got started with the organization and what it kind of means to you?
Okay, sure thing. Well, I grew up and still live in South Central Pennsylvania. As I indicated, as a kid in elementary school, I harvested black walnuts, and that was an interest. And then I remember my parents talking about hickory nuts, that they were the ultimate. They were decidedly better than black walnuts. And the problem with getting hickory nuts was the nut is so convoluted inside, it just locks onto the kernel. But now and then they would find a good tree that the nuts would crack out in corners and sometimes in halves. But the people who found those trees would not share that information with anyone. They were their nuts. They would make it a point that they harvested as quietly as they could without someone finding out about that. And so I don't know as a child that I ever ate a hickory nut. I found out what they tasted later when I got involved with my own trees. And so that was the beginning when I was 5-6 years old. And then later we moved to a kind of a rural area. And my father brought home two English walnut trees, and they were just seedlings, not grafted. Although the annoying thing is that he would every Sunday visit with a guy who was very well known in nut tree circles. His name was Fayette Etter. That he could have had grafted nut trees. And so, well, I tried to encourage him to get those, but he still wouldn't. And the last I know, those two trees in our little stamped front yard are still growing. And then I got interested in nut trees seriously by going to a group meeting at the Pennsylvania Farm Show in January. And there's an organization called the Pennsylvania Nut Growers. And I remember the organization, at least their meetings, were kind of disorganized. And I'm a retired teacher, and I have some idea about how to run a meeting. So almost by osmosis, I became a member. And the next thing I knew, I was to be the editor of her newsletter, which I did for, I think, 12 years. By that time, I was well hooked. And then to get into NNGA, the NNGA meets all over the nation, as well as sometimes in Canada. And there was a meeting that Pennsylvania was hosting. I got to be next to the guys who were in charge, and I said, well, I can do that.
I see a lot of similarities in the backgrounds. I tell Greg all the time how I got involved was saying, hey, I can do that. And I like how I think all four of us have teaching experience. That's a great look at, I think, some of the talents of nut tree enthusiasts. What I loved about all three of your stories is that you talked about kind of childhood significance in nut trees and or hobbies that's kind of influenced you. The thing that I absolutely love to learn about the NNGA, the thing that really drives me is the longevity. So the NNGA is over 100 years old. And I just think it's amazing that just like the trees, that we have multi-generational information to give people who are interested. So I'd like to talk now a little bit about the history or the start of the NNGA. So Tucker, could you talk a little bit about how the NNGA got started?
Well, there's a question about the name of the organization. They're not sure whether that really means North America or just those trees that would grow here in Pennsylvania in the north, but some people think it's the entire northern hemisphere, and that never got resolved, even by the people who decided to call this the Northern Nut Growers Association. My understanding is that there were a number of nut grower groups, some state and others, an attempt or so to get a national one going. And Jerry can probably verify some of this because he has read deeper than I have on it. But they had their first meeting, and they published a results of that. And I have a complete set of the Northern Nut Grower annual meetings. And the first one, I think, is maybe 3 pages long, but after that they started increasing. And it was a lot of the university people seemed to be involved, and pretty high-powered individuals. And there were names that people talk about of who did what and so forth, and which university. And it just sort of gravitated and started growing. And it's been, I would say, pretty solid ever since.
Great. Jerry, do you want to add to that?
Sure. You know, I live about 5 miles from the New York Botanical Gardens, which is in the Bronx. The first meeting was indeed held there in 1910. I think there were 10 people from the United States and Canada who came there. And it was at the invitation of our first president, Robert Morris. And the motivation for this stemmed from William Deming, who took a very active role in the organization for perhaps 30 or 40 years. Both Deming and Morris were physicians with property in Connecticut, but they also worked in New York City as doctors. And Deming had read somewhere that you could make a lot of money by planting nut trees. No problem caring for them. So in about 1909 or so, 1908, he spent about $400, an enormous sum in that day, to buy all sorts of trees from whatever nurseries existed at the time. Probably Snyder Brothers in Iowa was one, but there were others. And within about a year or two, every tree that he planted died. So he contacted Robert Morris. You see, and Deming at that time had a number of children, I think at least 4. He eventually had 5 children, and wanted to support them with this extra money from nuts. So he contacted Robert Morris, and the two of them convened the meeting in the New York Botanical Gardens. They appointed officers, had an agenda planned, and by 1911, the second meeting, there were more people in attendance, and an annual report was issued. And that's sort of how it began, and it snowballed from there.
Yeah, one of the things that really caught my eye was the poster of the original board members. I'm not sure if we still have a copy of that. I know it occasionally make its way to an annual meeting, but just to kind of see the forefathers of the organization always really interested me. Greg, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I have a theory on why it's called the Northern Nut Growers. And I think this kind of meshes in with Jerry's story about, you know, who started the organization. And I think the people who started it were, you know, more or less mid-Atlantic people who, you know, were academics or otherwise kind of aristocrats who, at the time they started, they were witnessing the growth of the pecan industry in the South. And nobody ever says this explicitly, but I got to think that, well, maybe we can grow nuts here in the North too. And so I think that the reason they called it the Northern Nut Growers was to sort of offer the contrast or alternative to what was then the, you know, the developing industry in the South, in the Southeast, which is not where pecans are native. So the pecans were brought in from, you know, from their native range farther west. And I think if you read the old annual reports, there was this, I think, some arrogance among the academics and the aristocrats that, oh, this nut growing stuff must be easy. The one that comes to mind is J. Russell Smith, who, of course, wrote the book Tree Crops that has inspired essentially all of us NNGA members, plus people, other people who aren't members. And I think it's noteworthy that J. Russell Smith, in spite of writing this book which inspired us all, he was an abysmal failure as a nut grower. And I think that after that kind of initial, oh, this nut growing thing ought to be easy, let's just plant some trees and start making money, then people realized that it isn't that easy. And then the organization kind of got handed off to, or I should maybe say, kind of the mission was assumed by kind of the backyard amateurs who liked the challenge and the fun of just trying to figure out how to grow it. And really for decades after that, and certainly through the time that my, you know, through the 1960s and 70s, there was not really a commercial success in nut growing, you know, kind of in the range of where the NNGA members, and they had picked up a lot of members in the Midwest by this point. So there was this, okay, let's solve the problem. And mainly it's how to graft nut trees, how to get nut trees established. What didn't seem to be much concern for what to do with the nuts after you harvested them, because most people didn't get that far. And I think it was probably around the 1980s is when people finally started having enough nuts to begin selling them. And I think from, you know, for the last 30 years or so, we have been slowly developing, you know, what might be called a commercial industry in the quote North, whatever that is.
Jerry or Tucker, do you have anything to add to the theory?
I did want to talk about later on working on the structure of the association. While I was secretary, I noticed that we would have a president, a vice president, a secretary, and a treasurer. And the secretary and treasurer were sort of expected to be reelected year in and year out. But the president would simply be in for 1 year, and then he was out, and the vice president would take over. And it seemed that about the time the president got a pretty good idea of how to run the organization, he was no longer president. Mm-hmm. And so I checked in and discovered that there wasn't anything that didn't say that said that the president could not be reelected. And so I suggested that the president sort of commit to a three-year term, but he would be reelected on an annual basis. And that seemed to work. And I think, Greg, I think you'll agree with me that that really got the organization in better condition.
I happened to be the person who was the first one to serve a three-year term as president back then.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So how do you feel about that, the three-year confinement, Greg?
Oh, I think it works well. It has created some bylaws issues, most important of which is that, and this is still the case in our bylaws, you know, that the chair of the awards committee is the immediate past president, and the committee used to be comprised of, you know, plus the five recent presidents, and so that really comprises a list of people. Now, if you've got three-year terms, you got to go back a long time to get members, and I think what people don't realize is that, okay, let's just say we at the nominating committee asks, how would you like to serve as vice president? And they say, oh yeah, that looks like a job that's not too hard, and so they don't realize they're in for a 9-year commitment at that point, because they got 3 years as vice president and then 3 years as president and then 3 years as chair of the awards committee. And
we don't want to scare off future members here.
So I think that, you know, that's the only problem that I think has been created.
I don't think there's any time commitment. You know, I know Carl Weske, in the 60s or 70s, was president for 5 years. So, you know, having too strict a limitation, I think would be a disadvantage.
Absolutely. So that kind of makes me want to circle back a little bit. Tucker, Greg, and Jerry, all of you guys kind of commented on the origin of the organization being primarily run by affluent or academic members, men generally. Can you talk a little bit about, and Greg, you touched on this a little bit, about how it kind of moved from the academic world to more of a hobbyist standpoint?
Yeah, I think that was kind of an organic switch, and certainly, you know, my father was a prime example of this trend, and that was at the time that happened. You know, at the time we started picking up the backyarders and the hobbyists was a time when there were lots of people like my dad who had a factory job that was not very challenging mentally, and you know, when you got home from work, there wasn't any work to do, and so there was time for hobbies, and land was cheap. You know, somebody on a, you know, median income could afford to buy 100 acres, which still blows me away. And so I think there were these kind of socioeconomic forces in play that allowed, you know, a certain, you know, small segment of the population to say, oh, I'd like to grow nut trees for fun, and they could afford to do it. And so I think that allowed, you know, a lot of people to become members who, you know, didn't have to be particularly wealthy. You just had to have the interest. And the NNGA provided this place where you could learn about it, you know, better than you could find. You know, there wasn't an internet then, and there weren't very many books. I mean, what books we do have were published by the NNGA. And so this was a means to, you know, for the amateurs to become experts was by being members. And then there was this kind of mutual feeding frenzy idea that once people got together and started doing it, then they helped each other, encouraged each other, and the thing kind of grew from there.
I could also add, you know, there was the Grange organization throughout the country, and people belong to that. Growing nut trees was certainly another agricultural interest that could be pursued. So farming in general, extension offices that were set up in the U.S., land grant universities, all of these, you know, had people who could then say, oh, look, you know, I'd like to try nut growing. The people had interest in that. And that's how it sort of grew also, I think.
So that's really interesting then to think about the socioeconomic impact or how it had an impact on the NNGA and its members. You know, now we're in a different kind of climate, and this isn't going to get political, but where do you see the NNGA in 5 years, in 10 years, in 20 years? Tucker, we'll start with you. Where do you see kind of the future of the NNGA and the type of members in the organization?
Well, I think the organization is going to continue flat out. And you just ran a thing and you increased the membership quite nicely, I understand. And we've had other things to increase membership. People get in for a couple years and sometimes they will drop out. It's very difficult to keep our widespread of knowledge and understanding of what we're talking about. And the new guy knows virtually nothing, and then some of the older folks, they know, I guess, everything they think they know. And there's some talk of maybe joining with another organization or so, because all these kinds of organizations are having a problem with membership, because they can get just about anything they want to know online, and so why pay for it? And it seems that for some good reason, I think, the nut growers persist and keep on going. And I think it will be going, but I think we're going to have to blend in with some other groups for strength in numbers. Mm-hmm.
Yes, the last couple of years we've had a number of younger people, 20s and 30s, even 40s, interested mostly in organic farming, permaculture, CSA operations, taking interest in nut growing. So these people have come to meetings. I know in New York State we've gotten a lot of these younger people coming. And I'm encouraging them to join not only the state organizations, but also the NNGA.
Greg, where do you kind of see the NNGA going and the type of members that might be a part of this organization in the future?
You know, from my vantage point of selling thousands of chestnut trees to people, I see a lot of people who are really interested in growing nut trees, you know, as a business. And certainly a percentage of those people come from kind of the philosophy of agroforestry or permaculture and organic farming. But the one thing that everybody has in common is that, oh, here's something here's an enterprise or a form of agriculture which is, you know, good for the planet, and it's good for the people who eat them, and hopefully we can make it good for the growers. The interesting thing to me is a whole lot of these people get into nut growing, and they're not really members of NNGA. It's like we have to then convince them that oh, you ought to be a member of the NNGA, and I'm not sure that we're doing a very good job at that, but I'm confident that once these people realize that, hey, doing this all by myself isn't going to work, and we need to share information with each other for the benefit of all of us. In other words, I can't make as much money or make money as easily, and you know, until and unless I gain information from other growers, and then that sort of also depends on my willingness to share my information. So I think there is this need for and purpose and function of the NNGA that is happening kind of like before people become members. And so I think it's not so much that NNGA members become interested in growing nut trees, but maybe nut tree growers will be interested in becoming NNGA members.
there are now organizations of veterans teaching veterans to become farmers. A lot of young men and women come back overseas with post-traumatic stress disorders or physical handicaps. And there are organizations from the United States, much about Canada, but from the United States, that train these men and women to become farmers. Growing Georgia puts out a profiles of people, and one of these ex-soldiers got involved with beekeeping, I believe in West Virginia, and in turn is training other veterans about farming. So this is a pool of people who are ideal for becoming members of the NNGA.
Excellent. That's really great. And that's great to hear that there are resources out there that are bringing folks of my generation into agriculture and farming.
I wanted to say that there's a number of commercial opportunities in duck growing now. What Greg is doing and the people in Michigan, they are reestablishing the chestnut industry that used to be major in this country, until the blight came through and slowed down the American chestnut pretty significantly. And another one would be hazelnut growing, because the Nutella people are willing to buy if you have the quality hazels. And that would be another one. And then Ernie Grimmo in Canada has established pretty much the heartnut industry, where you can make money on those. But I think Ernie still says, if you grow the heart nuts, I will buy them. And he processes them. So there's three nuts that I see that are coming in pretty good. And then the black walnut is another one. We have one of our members created an absolute perfect black walnut cracker grater. You start at one end, and at the other end, you have grated out black walnuts by size, by color, which is quite nice. And now we simply need the quality black walnuts to feed that. So I think there's a potential there. The one I'd like to see get established would be the hickories, but they're so difficult to crack that people find them a little tedious. But that might come in too also.
Another way to help people succeed commercially is through cooperatives. Greg Miller had started at Chestnut Cooperative, and there are other chestnut cooperatives. There's a black walnut cooperative in Nebraska. It would be great to get a hickory, you know, cooperative going somewhere as well. In the South, Fannie Lou Hamer helped to promote agricultural cooperatives for poor farmers, especially black farmers, in the rural South, and that tradition continues. Jim Emery of Kentucky noted a book on Hamer's activities that are still going on to this day. Again, these are opportunities to promote nut growing, to help people make money from it. The meeting we held in Tifton, Georgia in 2017 introduced new fruits, successful technologies in fruits and nuts that would help people make more money.
Just a plug here. Tucker mentioned the blights, which would be the American chestnut blight and the filbert blight that hits the hazelnuts. Next month, our podcast is actually going to feature some geneticists. So we're going to actually talk about some of the DNA work they are doing to stop the blight. So that's just a quick plug. But to kind of circle back to that, so we've talked a little bit about kind of the future of the members. So here I am, I'm in my early 30s. I'm lucky enough to own my own home with my husband. But a lot of people, I think, at my age, don't have the opportunity to own land or don't have the opportunity to plant trees or to inherit farms. So what advice could you guys give someone, the young, the quote-unquote younger generation who want to get involved in either hobby nut growing or nuts in general. What can they do to get involved and to learn more without going out and having 100 acres of nut trees?
Well, that's a really good question. And one that I don't really have a good answer for, because to start any kind of farm, but especially a farm that involves a perennial crop, kind of the financial barriers to doing that, you know, starting with buying land and then buying everything you need and planting the trees and then waiting for an income, that's a huge barrier. But I think that, you know, we are seeing people who are wealthy, who have the money to invest, you know, in this kind of agriculture and do it mainly for their own kind of philosophical reasons, but it does have to work economically. So I see an opportunity for people who want to start enterprises, who have the money, and then hire people to run it, you know, to make it work. And so there might be the chance to work for somebody who is, you know, starting a nut growing or other perennial agricultural enterprise. So these are, I think, just kind of now developing, but I think that's one possibility.
I was going to say that I would concentrate on the person who would willing to start small, maybe just their backyard, for them to get a taste. And if you can get them then as a member, we have information that we could start to feed them and show them how that chestnuts, like I mentioned, would be a way to get started, and they could get very commercial there, and or at least get some decent income, make it worth their time. For the most part, the nut trees, in my experience, don't require a lot of maintenance like an apple tree or a peach tree by far. Greg, as you know, has already come up with a solution for the chestnut weevil, and he has that down to a science. That's simply hot water, which you must maintain, and that takes care of the weevil. But I think just get their feet wet, and then they might then take off and become commercial, but not necessarily.
Yeah, I'd like to add, you know, probably should have said this first, that someone who does already have some land, you know, 1 acre, 5 acres, 10 acres, or, you know, some amount of land that would be too small to be a standalone operation, but big enough to make some money, you know, if those small landowners, backyard farmers, they can become part of a cooperative, and that's why the cooperative model works so well, because the co-op will take care of the capital equipment and the marketing, and the grower can just focus on growing their small amount of the crop, and collectively all the growers put it all together, and then they have something you know, worth harvesting and worth selling. And then these small growers can take advantage of the economy of scale.
Well, a different take. If people do not have land, one of the efforts of the Nutty Buddy Collective is to involve people in harvesting nuts, and they've started now in a large scale with acorns, to process them, sell them eventually, and they're doing this with other nuts as well. So people can forage. They can also find land owned by other people or institutions, schools, houses of worship, universities, parks, public parks, that would welcome the planting of trees, of nut trees. In New York, there are communities that are involved in vine cutting. I'm going to be part of that tomorrow if it doesn't rain, where you do a hands-on saving of trees that are being killed by a variety of vines. These are people willing to do hands-on work and very interested when I come to an activity like this with nuts and a nutcracker and literature. Education is important. We, you know, in the NNGA need to make people aware of the benefits of nut trees. Land-grant universities, or even universities like Delaware Valley University in Pennsylvania, that was started as a private university about 100 years ago, had programs in horticulture, but very little in agriculture. And one of the things I've done is to get the chair of the department more interested in food-bearing trees. The New York group met there in spring of last year. I'm getting this individual involved in hosting our 2020 meeting in Pennsylvania at the site. So reaching out to interested parties like this who do not have land on their own is another way we can communicate nut tree planting and popularize it.
I'll just plug NAFEX, the North American Fruit Explorers. That's part of their mission. So if you're listening to this podcast and that's something you're interested in, please check out their website. They're interested in a lot of foraging and a lot of looking at historical aspect of fruits and nuts.
So yeah. There's gleaning organizations where volunteers are organized going to a place where there are huge harvests of nuts or fruits and gathering these for people who are needing food pantries.
So we have time for one more question here, and it's one I'd like to call it my soundbite question. But if you could give one piece of advice for a future or younger member of the NNGA, what would it be and why?
One of the things I look forward to each year in going to meetings and contacting people is the social contact. I count members, of the nut growing groups as personal friends. So one of the many benefits of having an interest in nut growing is that there are people throughout your community, state, nationally and internationally, who have similar interests and a similar passion. So involving yourself in a passion like nut growing, having fun, looking forward to meeting these people again is important.
Well, I need to tell you about my first meeting with Jerry at an NNGA meeting. And here's this guy from Yonkers, New York, living on the fourth floor of an apartment. Didn't own a inch of land, and I was curious, why would this guy be involved with nut trees? And he just very simply said that, he wanted to feed the world. And so that's why he kept stressing, grow something that produces food. And so nut trees, he felt, would do that, and I concur that he is exactly right. Probably one of the best ones for the temperate zone. That's my Jerry story.
I would say to anybody, any prospective NNGA member, why should I do this? I would say, join the NNGA and save yourself from making the first 100 years worth of mistakes.
Yeah, good. Good, Greg.
Well, that's exactly why we're doing this podcast, is I want to help create kind of this digital history too, because I hear it frequently at the NNGA meetings that, by the time you actually learn something, then you kind of die and then, information's lost. So I do want to create this digital archive, and there's just so much great information in the nutshells and the annual reports, the written history. But I think a social history, or, even something as colloquial as kind of the conversations that members have between members is really important to record and to keep. All right. Well, thank you, Jerry, Greg, and Tucker for being my first guests on the podcast. Hopefully it'll be a success. There's one other thing I want you guys to do before I leave, and that is independently, I want each of you to say, "Go nuts," which is what's the name of our podcast. And I'm going to take a collection of everyone saying it, and that's going to be our introduction. So, Jerry, give us our best go nuts.
Go nuts.
Perfect. Greg?
Go nuts.
Great. Tucker?
Well, grow nuts.
Fantastic. All right. Well, thank you very much.